Professor Thomas Green is extremely well known in and around the study of martial arts in various ways, and I'm talking to him right now. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you, Paul?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm okay. I've been a bit depressed about the lockdown from time to time, but these conversations kind of keep me sane. It's therapy for me, this.
Oh, absolutely. I search my pantry to see things that I might not have, so I'll have an excuse to go to the grocery store and interact with someone aside from my daughter. So,
with humans. I'm going to share a screen. Where are we? So if we go Google Chrome, I'll share that. So you are a professor of anthropology in the College of Liberal Arts at Texas, Texas A&M, isn't it?
Correct.
And you mainly teach issues in folklore and the supernatural, and you mainly publish around all sorts of different aspects of the martial arts. So you've published in our journal twice, I think, so far. The first time you talked about the 52 hand blocks, the vernacular Afro-American martial art. I'm going to ask you a little bit about that in a minute. And then most recently, you've published something that's possibly a bit more controversial around the 52 hand blocks, sexual dominance and the mother deer's archetype. I'm going to ask you about both of those things. The first thing to ask though does the 52 hand block exist? What's the nature of the evidence we have for this?
Originally I encountered it as Jailhouse Rock.
Yeah.
And ran across an article in one of the popular martial arts magazines that talked about Lethal Weapon, the first Lethal Weapon with Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
And one Capoeira in there. There was Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but then there was something called Jailhouse Rock, and there was a gentleman there who has since shared with me and given me quite a few bruises and bumps along the way. Dennis Newsom, who was one of the fight choreographers. It triggered several things with me. One was there had been an article in Black Belt magazine, I guess a decade before, about prison martial arts. And should we have martial arts in prison? And gave a bit of information about something that was not called Jailhouse Rock. It was generally, there was a reference to the penal institution that housed it or spawned it, which caught my attention because at that time I was training in a martial art with a friend who was a prison guard at one of the Texas prison units. And he and I were talking over coffee one day, and he said, you know, the convicts here just they have this weird way of fighting. It's better to look good in it than necessarily be effective. And he I said, well, you know, is it like any of the martial arts we've studied, because we had both studied karate, kung fu? And he said, no. And then said, is it like boxing? And he said, well, some of it is. But he said that he had literally seen convicts drive each other into the ground with overhead punches, clubbing punches like this.
Yeah.
And so that was the first connection that I made with that. And then as I began researching it more and more because of Dennis Newsome and other people that I ran into along the way as I was exploring this, I kept coming across little hints of vernacular African-American martial art. And was fortunate enough to run into one of my research partners, Joe Spence.
Oh, yeah.
And Joe, as you know, probably is the master historian.
Well, I was going to ask you about Joe, because I don't know much of his story, but I was going to ask you a little bit about him maybe if we had time.
Sure. And we can return to that if you like. Yeah. But Joe then began to give me more information. And I met Joe in Met, in quote, through an online publication that was a history of martial art called Chronos.
Oh, yeah.
And there were references when I was audacious enough in 2000, 2001 to think I could write an encyclopedia of the martial arts, I kept finding gaps. Oh, I never heard of this. Oh, maybe I should explore that. So I contacted Joe about a couple of things. And one of the things that we then began to discuss is this big gap where African and African descended martial arts in the Americas came from. So Joe then began to feed me information on that. And then eventually we collaborated on some works. But anyway, so I began to follow, I go down that rabbit hole, and was fortunate enough to train with and work with some people like Little John Davis and Daryl Sargent, Kalindi Iyi, Daniel Marks. Met Douglas Century, who gave us really the first kind of, although it was not intended to be, ethnography of the 52s in his book Street Kingdom. Okay. So I just began to get more and more enmeshed in this and more interested in this, and even recalled things from that I had seen my fellow hoodlums do in public school.
Yeah.
That were very unusual.
To what extent did you, are there different variants? Is there an agreed history? Because your recent stuff, especially, you write it in terms of a folklorist's approach to it, and that's the way that you conceptualize it, these different stories and different kind of ways of telling, and therefore different figures and different or repeated recurring figures, recurring images. Do these differ from state to state, prison to prison, decade to decade? I mean, how does all this play out?
There is, in general, there will be a description of particular styles of prison fighting. 52s is just one of them. Mm-hmm. And they'll be named after the prison. For example, State Prison of New York developed a style called Stato.
Okay.
And then you have in this early Black Belt article that I mentioned mention of the Comstock style, which is named after another prison. In talking with Kalindi Iyi, who's noted primarily for African systems or African-inspired systems, Kalindi began telling me about one they had in Michigan called Jacktown. And it was in the, and the prison is usually named after the towns where they are. It was Jackson, prison in Jackson, Michigan, is, I believe, the derivation of that. And there are different styles. And even on the street, some of the people I've interviewed have said, well, you know, we have developed this style, or the guys from another part, often of New York, is where I was getting some of the information, have developed a style where they even use their legs or use kicking or use knees, because the streets there are up and down. So you develop strong legs and you, et cetera, build on that.
So is there anything that we can, in terms of commonality, so you say, you're suggesting that it's often about looking good, it's often about fighting according to certain aesthetic considerations in order to kind of maybe ritualistically humiliate or demonstrate your own excellence. And then it sounds as well like you've got, there's some commonalities with the kind of, the big stories about like the difference between Northern and Southern Chinese styles, like, well, that's a mountainous region. So they're there. And I mean, how does this relate to any thing other than making up stories or regional little subcultural flourishes? Or, I mean, how do you see this from a meta perspective?
That's such a question, but you get the Southern styles in Chinese martial art, and they didn't kick high a lot, and they had very stable stances and mainly hand and arm techniques, because this was practiced on the opera boats, and they had unstable surfaces. Well, you know, when you look at Savat, of course, that sort of blows that argument away to a certain extent, which is a sailor style. But you do have, for example, it's not quite geographic, but many of these styles that have been traced back to the plantation experience, knocking and kicking, right? Knocking meaning headbutting, and kicking meaning kicking. Those, in many cases, then have been tied to, not in all cases, of course, but in many cases, have been tied to the fact that the slave owners on the plantation would often have kind of human cockfights. And many of the people that came out on top of that were not only good headbutters, but they became boxers, or had watched boxers, or, and it was derived from that. The 52s that I have seen the most of are ones that are based in boxing. Mm-hmm. So you have that kind of, as with the populations among the enslaved African in the U.S., you have many different ethnic groups, mm-hmm. Many different life ways, the farmers, versus the herdsmen, the pastoralists. Mm-hmm. And so you bring a little bit of that into it. You finally get a mix. You'll see some tendencies toward, I haven't seen the wrestling, but I've heard a description where, and from people who are reliable, who have seen it, a comparison between the kind of wrestling that you get in the 52s or the vernacular African-American martial arts to side hold wrestling, which is popular in some regions of Africa. You see comparisons to particular kinds of dances, leaping dances, dances that will involve particular rhythms, particular aesthetic styles, particular uses of specific parts of the body. But then when you get that, melding in the originally the plantation context, and then after emancipation, you weren't going to have African Americans moving in to the same neighborhood that old Massa was in. And even what Dennis Newsom argues is that the prison systems that we had in the U.S., and this is especially true of Texas, I think, were simply continuations of the old plantation system. You had the overseer and you had the people, convicts farming as they had before. And what Dennis would claim is that they brought these knocking and kicking styles into the prisons. They, of course, saw what some a sweet move that someone else had and would pick up on it. And also one of the ways of letting off steam and apparently entertaining the guards and the local politicians involved boxing. Jack Johnson, one of his, he kind of cut his teeth on these battle royals, which were, harked back to a gladiatorial kind of system where you'd put a bunch of guys in the ring and whoever came out intact or semi-intact was then the winner. Well, all of those are perpetuations of these older plantation amusements for the overseers.
So tell me about the recurrent figure of Mother Deer then. I mean, how did you first get wind of this character or this type? And what do you think is the significance of that?
Mother Deer, for people who, haven't known Mother Deer, perhaps that's too much double entendre, but who are not familiar with that figure, was reputed to be the founder of the 52 system, which is, most people will say, is the dominant system. He was a homosexual, African-American, he was known for, if he was attracted to another one of the inmates, if the inmate didn't submit, he would beat then that chosen partner into submission. You get, as with all folk heroes, you get various descriptions of Mother Deer. Some Mother Deer is huge and is able to do this. Some I've had descriptions of him as being very effeminate and even having long, polished nails like a woman, and using those nails to vicious effect in his fights. The main thing was that many of the people who purport to know the 52s will try to claim some lineage that goes back to Mother Deer. The irony of that, of course, is that figure of Mother Deer, which in the South is a very familiar term among white population, Southern white population, and African American population as grandmother, as the maternal figure in the family. And I think some of that is to develop the irony between this nurturing, loving figure and this brutal rapist. Mm. And a figure that is widely spread, especially when people began to hear of the term 52s, which was at the turn of the 21st century, they began to kind of pursue who he was. And I've been given names. Well, his real name, or his name in the projects, was, but in prison, his Mother Dear. We never hear, I suppose Mother Dear was in for life, because I have never heard of Mother Dear being released and wreaking havoc on the street. But you run into a lot of people claiming that they are bona fide practitioners of the 52s because of the connection to Mother Dear.
Okay.
Yeah. And one of the things that was pointed out to me is, many of Mother Dear's students had been his sexual partners before. Mm. So, I mean, there's all kinds of ambivalence going on there. Mm. There was a tie to Mother Dear, the 52s, and the NGE, the Nation of Gods and Earths, which is a 5% nation of Islam. But the 5%ers absolutely abhorred homosexuality. And so, I mean, it's as with all folk tales and all myths, very confusing, as many cross currents, but the name appears over and over and over again. Every informant I've had has mentioned Mother Dear. But then you also see similar figures like Boxing Betty or Brutus, who are not a part of the African-American repertoire of prison fighters, and who are very, very much the same. So, and that's why I say, claim he's an archetype.
So, as a folklorist, are you more interested in the real biographical characters that made up this figure, or are you more interested in the way that it functions to legitimate or delegitimate, or to? I mean, it's not. I mean, why do people need to make a lineage claim? Because I mean, you could just say, well, I went to prison and I learned how to fight, because everyone is really violent place, and I come out now and I teach you the prison style. Why do you need to say I was taught by Mother Dear or Boxing Betty or Brutus? What does that need? What is that?
The same reason that in Chinese martial arts, there'll be the tie back to Damo, or back to the Shaolin Temple, or back to the Southern Shaolin Temple that was destroyed by fire and never rebuilt. It gives something real and tangible to something that's simply a story. And what I'm really interested in is the agendas. What's the agenda behind this? I don't care whether it's true or not. Yeah. The people who are telling me the stories care very much whether it's true or not.
What kind of agendas do you find? Is it literally just legitimacy, status, customers?
Yeah, it is. It's legitimacy. Mm-hmm. As I pointed out in some of the things I've written on the 52s, style, status, social hierarchy are very, very important in this. And I don't hesitate to call it a martial art, although it's not technically. They are very eager for me to accept that, and for other people to accept that, because you can say, well, that's not just a hodgepodge of things. It had an inventor. It had someone who passed
Is it as well the idea that it's a system? It's not just, so I mean, if you look at, I spent some time looking at the early British books on jiu-jitsu, and for a long time it was called tricks and techniques, like the Japanese tricks, the Japanese techniques. But after a while, and people have associated this with Kano, it becomes a system. It's an art. It's a path. It's a way. It's not just here's an arm lock. Quick. It's the person who brandishes or embodies that practices a completely comprehensive style. Is that the difference? It's not like I learned a trick, like stand on your toes and punch your jaw. It's not that. It's a style. Is that what it is?
I believe it is. I find enough uniformity among the various regional styles to say, yeah, it is. And there's transmission on the street. Mm-hmm. There was even, there have been several people who've tried to capitalize on this and make it systematic, as you would see with karate or judo or various forms of jiu-jitsu. And if you look at them closely, the more recent ones, you see that basically they're taking their karate style and calling it 52s.
Yeah, okay.
There was even one popular online figure who literally took the 52 hand blocks as referring to a series of 52 moves.
There are 52 of them. Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there was one of the videos that he put out that was 52 hand blocks, the first 10 blocks.
Okay. That's white belt. That's yellow belt. Is it? That's the yellow belt syllabus.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's it is effective. One of the things that unifies all of them, I've seen that they are playing with rhythm. Mm-hmm. In one of the previous podcasts, I remember the discussion of rhythms and broken rhythms and getting your opponent to follow you in stick fighting. There are those kinds of things with the 52s, and you can see it in certain boxers who have spent time often as kids in a youth facility and come out of that having a particular style that you see in the street forms. And it apparently developed independently. If you remember Archie Moore's armadillo guard, like this. Well, Dennis Newsom demonstrates that as one of the guards, one of the moves of the 52s. And you also, within that guard, you have the transitions like this, right? To the L, switch in the L. Yeah. So you have enough of those things that you find in regional adaptation to regional adaptation to say, all right, there's some things in common there. Is it because they work? Well, yeah, probably. Is it because they look good? Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. There are, you remember Sonny Liston would train to the music of Night Train and would be jumping rope or punching bag to dun da dun da dun da dun da dun da dun. Well, if you look at some of the more contemporary African American boxers, you see that that rhythm is much more hip hop. And you see that on the street, the rhythms and the way they're playing with them and breaking them up are much more hip hop. I've had some informants tell me though that, and this is where you can say it maybe like a bag of tricks, because one of my resource persons claimed that they took moves from the old Hong Kong Kung Fu movies. They took moves from boxing. They took moves that their grandmother showed them, where she would take a bottle of hot sauce that she carried with her to season her food, put it on the palm of her hand, slap somebody across the eyes with it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that female transmission, I haven't been able to follow very far, but.
Well, I was going to ask you about what other things, your website talks about, like, indigenous vernacular martial arts interest you, especially in North America. I mean, what other research trajectories have you had over the last however long? You know, what are the main things that have occupied you over recent decades? Because we always just talk about this, but there must be... there must be more things. I know you were planning on going to China. If it hadn't been for the pandemic, that would have been imminent. So, I mean, you weren't going to talk about the 52s in China, were you? You were going to find out.
No, not at all. we were looking at, and this was inspired by my research partner in China, John Guodong, what we were looking at was a vernacular version or a splinter version, however you want to phrase it, of Wu style Tai Chi that had been brought to the city, to an urban area, yeah. And how what had essentially been a village art was adopted and adapted within that urban context. What did they do? How did it differ? Well, one of the things, obviously, when you bring a vernacular art into an urban context or try to systematize it, is that it's not tied to things like festival. It's not tied to dance. It's not tied to religion or medicine or all the things that you find a vernacular martial art tied to. Mm-hmm. We were pursuing that, and also the whole idea of what happens when you try to globalize martial arts. Mm. And you can see that all over the place. I looked at Dambe, which is a Nigerian form of boxing, several years ago. And looking now at some of the styles of Silat that want to enter the global arena.
Yeah.
And what's happening? Well, as with the case with both of them in their natural context, they are an element of culture. You don't go down to the shopping mall and sign up and sign a waiver and hand them your credit card, and then in the evening go home and you may wear your Gojiru t-shirt, but you're living your mundane life, your daily life. You may carry some of those values, but it's not a part of your religious practice generally. It's not a part of your initiation into a social system. It's, you may think it's good for you and healthy, but it's not built in, tied in intimately to your medical system. Mm-hmm. And we have some carryover of some of these things in martial arts like Qing Yi, mm-hmm. based on the five elements, which is intimately tied to religion, and each of the strikes in Xing Yi is connected to a particular vital organ of the body and is supposed to stimulate it, kind of like a moving yoga. Hmm. So what happens when you take something out of its natural context? What is its natural context? How does it plug into healing on the shamanic level? Hmm. How does it plug into dance and drama, which I was interested in early on with my folklore. And in fact, in thinking back over it, it's odd because I have the two things that I was really fascinated with in folklore were the storytelling, folk history, and play and games, whether those games were verbal, as with riddling, or whether they were a kind of ritual, as with the Native American hand game, which is a form of gambling that took on a religious significance, or with drama. The very recent article that I did with Guadong was on a folk drama that is inserted into the practice of plum blossom boxing.
Okay.
So I keep returning to those kinds of cultural movement, play, competition themes over and over.
Are you? You? I guess. I mean, there's a picture in my head of a rich indigenous martial art. We'll call it a martial art for simplicity. That when it enters the global arena is deracinated in some sense, commodified, kind of. Formalized in different ways, and then it functions in according to a different kind of cultural logic, maybe a logic of consumption, logic of cultural fantasy, maybe even a diasporic kind of fantasy logic. But you're interested in the other side. You're interested in the first side. You're interested in the place in which it exists in most rich and fertile, possibly kind of organically occurring connections. You're not interested in going down into town, into the city, or into a shopping mall somewhere, and going, I would like to study Penchak Silat as opposed to Taekwondo, as opposed to Judo, all in these. Would that be right?
Been there far too often. And the teachers who I felt were most authentic were ones who were not charging. And in fact, I a couple of times had to harass them into teaching me. And they were bringing it from a family tradition or a village tradition. I was an interesting thing at one point when I was deep into studying the 52s and getting data, I had an African-American Arnis teacher teaching modern Arnis. And one day, for some reason, he decided that he was going to show us some other stuff that would be good for fighting that didn't even involve sticks. And one of the members of the class face off on him, and he dropped into a squat immediately, grabbed the guy's pants cuffs, and stood up.
Yeah.
And threw him on his back.
Yeah.
And that was from the 52s, the pants leg trip, or the flip. There were a lot of names for them. But and I said, where did you get that? And he was, you know, PhD, very, refined kind of guy. Also, taught Gong Fu, and I said, where did you get that? and he said, oh, I got that from my dad.
Right.
And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, is there anything else you do after that? Mm-hmm. And he said, oh yeah, you tap dance on them. And I said, tap dance? He said, yeah, my dad was a dancer. And I said, foolishly, show me. So he did the same thing to me, and I'm not entirely sure what he did, but I felt him drilling, and fortunately he had no shoes, drilling these kicks into my ribs and up and down my body. I said, you know that's something that is part of the 52s and knocking and kicking. And he said, what? And he said, no, you know, my dad just learned this on the streets of Virginia. So, you know, there was that Southern connection, but this was its original environment. And he was in, you know, while he was teaching us, the Arnis said, oh, here, I'm going to give you a little treat. I'm going to show you some extra stuff. And that was one of the things that he selected. But what I've also been interested in is ritual drama, religion, medicine. And as I got into more vernacular, I was going to say more genuine, but more vernacular, down home ways of fighting, I saw these connections over and over again to larger systems, larger cultural systems.
Okay. So you are, you're kind of gradually moving into a kind of semi-retirement now from the university work and from the teaching and so on. Are you still supervising PhDs, or are you taking a back step from that kind of thing now?
I have a couple whose committees I'm serving on, and then I have some others who are kind of informal advisees. Mm-hmm. When they have to know something about folklore and their major professor doesn't, you know, okay, he or she sends those people to me. So I'm still doing that. I've had a couple of applications over the last year or so, okay, of people who wanted to do the PhD with me, but I've said, yeah, I'm sorry, but I want to go on and do other things.
So what's the next other thing? I mean, are you just going to try and get to China when you can, or are you going to line some other projects up that you can maybe do in to start in lockdown-ish and maybe hopefully go out into the world at the next stage?
I am right now co-editing a issue of sustainability online journal on martial arts tourism.
Okay.
And just mainly selecting people who I knew were well versed on that and asking them to contribute. You had Lauren Griffin on earlier, people like that. Yeah. I am thinking maybe it's time to start pulling the disparate pieces of the 52s into 52s as I wrote it originally, plus retrospective, because I see some changes there, and then not necessarily be done with it, but be able to say, okay, now.
Yeah.
And as one of the things that I'm working on with my research partner in China, Guadong, is some of the more mystical, I suppose, but also medical aspects of village plum blossom boxing. For example, there's a legend about the origin of plum blossom boxing that involves a wheelbarrow made of 108 weapons that were smuggled into the village in order to arm the people and teach them plum blossom boxing. Now, 108 is a very important number. It is anyone who's read The Water Margin knows. And 108 we find throughout the literature and the teachings in Asian traditions. There was an attempt to reconstruct that 108 weapon wheelbarrow, and I think the most they got was about 69. So we're not talking there about, this is a perfect example of agendas, we're not talking there about real history. We're talking about history that has an agenda, because the master that was brought in with the 108 weapon wheelbarrow was able to, as I recall, at one point almost to duplicate Moses crossing the Red Sea, parting the waters. And so he was a man of power, a shaman, as well as a martial arts master. Looking at some of that with Guodong, looking at some of the transformations, almost an internal alchemy that is practiced with standing meditation. I guess moving toward numerology, medicine, and how that plays into martial arts tradition, which is nothing new. It's not groundbreaking.
It's a bit of a difference. It's a bit of a move from prison styles, isn't it, in North America to go to. I mean, in one sense, it's perfectly consistent. It's perfectly, it makes perfect sense. But in another sense, it's a world away, isn't it? It's like a world away.
And the way that I got into looking at plum blossom boxing and some of the Chinese vernacular styles was through the 52s. I was at a conference on play and sport in Nanjing. Okay. And a guy came up to me and said, I saw that you're talking about fighting in America. I would like for you to come see my paper. It's on May boxing. And it didn't plug into me that the May was plum boxing, plum boxing. But he was a nice guy. And I said, sure, yeah, I'll come. And I went. And that was Guodong. And we hit it off. And he saw some interesting things in what I was talking about, that whole vernacular idea. And I saw some very interesting things in what he was talking about in terms of transmission of a martial culture rather than bits and pieces here and there, or places where you go to a dojo or a kun and you maybe go through an initiation, depending on how traditional it is, to something where you grow up in it. Mm-hmm. And it's part of your medical system. It's part of your heritage. And it cannot be divorced from dance or religion and still be the same thing.
Okay. Well, hopefully you'll get this done. You'll get some field work. You'll get some stuff. Because we were meant to be meeting again at our conference in Marseille in July, but it hasn't actually been cancelled because of the pandemic. It's what we're looking at, avenues and ways to make it more online, maybe. But the following year, we're having it hopefully again. Hopefully if we're allowed to travel, conference in Switzerland on martial arts tradition and globalization. So that seems like that might be a wonderful context to...
Absolutely. Yeah, it broke my heart when the conference in Marseille was cancelled. Whoops.
I think it's... Yeah, I know. God, it's depressing, isn't it? But if that's the biggest problem we have, then we're quite lucky. But Thomas Green, I would like to thank you ever so much for your time. It was great talking to you, and we'll meet again.
Oh, thank you very much. I am absolutely certain, Paul,